We're going not to the break right now, which we usually do, but because we have Robert Fisk on his satellite phone at this moment, we want to go directly to him. Robert Fisk, we'll get your comment at the beginning, hearing that Wesley Clark is now running for president as the anti-war warrior, and then we'd like to get your observations of what's happening right now on the ground in Iraq.
Well, I have to say, first of all, about General Clark, that I was on the ground in Serbia and Kosovo when he ran the war there, and he didn't seem to be very anti-war at the time. I had as one of my tasks to go out over and over again to look at the civilian casualties of that war. At one point, NATO bombed a hospital in which Yugoslav soldiers, against the rules of law, were hiding, along with the patients, and almost all the patients were killed. This was the war, remember, where the first attack was made on a radio station, the television, Serb radio and television building. Since then, we've had attacks twice on the Al Jazeera television stations. First of all, in Afghanistan in 2001, and then killing their chief correspondent again in Baghdad this year. This was a general who, I remember, bombed a series of bridges, in one of which an aircraft bombed a train, and after he'd seen the train and had come to a stop, the pilot bombed the bridge again. I saw one occasion when a plane came in, bombed a bridge over a river in Serbia proper, as we like to call it, and after about 12 minutes, when rescuers had arrived, the bridge too narrow even for tanks, bombed the rescuers. I remember General Clark telling us that more than 100 Yugoslav tanks had been destroyed in the weeks of that war, and when the war came to an end, we discovered the number of Yugoslav tanks destroyed were 11. 100 indeed. So this is not a man, frankly, whom if I was an American, I'd vote for. But not being American, I don't have to.
Robert Fisk speaking to us in Iraq. And then you have the time that the British general, Michael Jackson, Wesley Clark, had told him to get his British troops to the airport before the Russians got there so it wouldn't be perceived that the Russians were liberating. And General Michael Jackson responded to him, "I'm not going to start World War III."
Yes, Jackson did indeed say that, and one member of Jackson's staff has confirmed to me that the quote is true. I think one or two of the words, are probably the verb is wrong, but World War III was correct. There was a very strange atmosphere to that war, and over and over again, when NATO had bombed a target that was clearly illegitimate, or when they killed large numbers of civilians, they were either silent or they lied. We had the very famous occasion, or infamous occasion, when American troops, or rather, I'm sorry, American aircraft, bombed an Albanian refugee convoy in Kosovo and claimed later, or NATO claimed later, it was probably Serb aircraft. And it was only when we got there and found the NATO markings on the bombs that NATO fessed up and admitted they'd done it themselves and had been confused. When I went to the scene months later and tracked down the survivors, it turned out that although they were confused, NATO aircraft had gone on bombing that convoy for 35 minutes, even though there were civilians there, because mixed in among them, most cruelly, this was an act of Milosevic's regime, were military vehicles as well. We shouldn't be romantic about the Serb military or the Serb security police. They were killers and murderers. But NATO, in its war against the Serbs, committed a number of acts which I think got very, very close to being war crimes, and General Clark was the commander. So this is the man who wants to be the president, Democratic president of the United States of America. Well, I don't interest myself very much in what he thinks about the last war in Iraq. I watched it at first hand and have my own opinions, but I sure as hell know what it was like to be under the bombs of his war in Serbia.
And well, Robert Fisk,
I thought was very clean.
Robert Fisk, this is Juan Gonzalez here with Amy. In speaking about civilian casualties, you've been doing several articles now on the story that is not being covered at all, especially here in the United States, which is the civilian toll, the lives being lost every day in Iraq as a result of the U.S. occupation. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I started doing this story here because I'm doing a series of articles because I was very struck by an article that appeared in the New York Times last week that talked about the terrible toll of casualties over the summer months. And it was paragraph 3 before I realized that the terrible toll applied only to 70 or 72 American soldiers in this country. And thousands of Iraqi civilians are dying by gunfire and other forms of violence in this country since April 9 because of the anarchy and chaos let loose after the, quote, liberation, unquote, of Baghdad. Again, we know, don't need to be romantic about Saddam. It was his government that committed the crimes before the war. It's now Iraqis who are committing the crimes after the war. But the real problem is that there is no security, and what is happening is an absolute slaughter every night of Iraqi people, either murdered in revenge killings by thieves, gunned down at American checkpoints by trigger-happy U.S. soldiers, involved in family feuds. I've just come, literally as I speak to you now, from a mortuary in Baghdad. They've just taken in 21 gunshot victims, dead. I spoke to five of the bereaved family, all shot down with people trying to steal their cars, or killed by thieves in the night, or killed in killings which were by persons unknown. Weaponry is flourishing here. You hear the shooting every night. The whole of Baghdad skitters with gunfire. I went to one hospital, the Al-Mulk Hospital, where the mortuary attendant told me that almost 40% of the total dead that come in at that mortuary are killed at U.S. checkpoints by soldiers, either because the cars approach too quickly to the checkpoint, or because American troops come under fire and fire back at the civilians in the area without making direct contact with whoever is their aggressor. On one occasion recently, for example, 4 days ago, a woman and her child were brought dead to the Al-Mulk Hospital after they were killed by U.S. forces who opened fire at people who were shooting in the air at a wedding party. Over and over again this happens. We've had a case about 6 weeks ago, which I personally investigated, in which two men got too close, drove up to a U.S. checkpoint. It wasn't a usual checkpoint. It was just a piece of barbed wire thrown across the road at a very poor suburb of Baghdad called Hayal Galani. The Americans opened fire at the car. When the car was burned out, I counted around 23 bullet holes in it, but the bullets caught fire to the petrol, and I don't know if they were still alive or not, but the two passengers, both males, were burned alive. They were burned to death anyway. I assume two may have survived as the car was burning. As the car was on fire, according to those who saw it happen, the Americans packed up and abandoned their checkpoint. I went to the mortuary again at the Al-Mulk Hospital afterwards and found these two skeletons with burned flesh on, their identity papers long ago consumed by the fire, and the car itself, the registration plate, had melted into the road. So again, two Iraqi families were waiting that night for loved ones who would never come home.
In one of your articles, Robert, you estimate that as many as perhaps 1,000 Iraqis a week are dying across the country, and that you're having trouble getting to the hospitals. The occupation authorities are not allowing journalists or making it difficult for journalists to get to hospitals or mortuaries.
Absolutely. The Coalition Provisional Authority, the occupation authorities call themselves that, have told through the Ministry of Health, the new Ministry of Health under the CPA here, who, of course, work to the occupation authorities, that journalists are not allowed to go to hospitals unless they have official permission from the new ministers, who, of course, work for the occupation authorities. This means we're not, in theory, supposed to find out the figures. In fact, we can get into the hospitals because we know many of the doctors. There are other ways in, and usually the security guards are very sympathetic towards us. They're Iraqi, and they want us to tell the story of this great tragedy for the Iraqis. I'll just give you the Baghdad City Morgue, which I've just spent 6 hours in. Yesterday, they had 21 dead, of whom 12 were killed by gunfire. This morning, they had another 5 by 10 a.m. Baghdad time. Now, if you add that up and you turn it into a month of killings, and you remember that there's 20 dead a day of gunfire being brought even to the Najaf Cemetery, which is about 200 miles south of Baghdad, who are killed by violence. Not just, of course, by the Americans, killed by family revenge, killings, shootings by thieves, people trying to stop looters who get killed by accident, caught in crossfire. You're talking of at least 1,000 Iraqis dying every week. But, of course, it's impossible, not just because of the restrictions placed on journalists going to the hospitals, but it's impossible to go to every hospital in every city of Iraq every morning and put together the death toll. But it is extraordinary. And, you know, I had one case this morning, a young man only son of a Shiite from the very poorest area of Baghdad had been killed at his door, no one knew why. Four very, very angry Shiites arrived with his body at the mortuary, one of them in militia uniforms, I think he was a member of the so-called Badr Brigade, and one of them was shouting and said, this is because there is no security, America doesn't want us to have security, it wants to divide our society, we won't allow it, we will explode ourselves against the Americans, he said. He was talking about suicide bombers. This is a Shiite, not a Sunni from the so-called Sunni Triangle. So what is happening is that there's a growing feeling among Iraqis, at least those who are politically inclined, that the Americans do not want to stop the insecurity. Among those Iraqis who don't take such a conspiratorial view, there is a milder, but in my view, quite devastating view or attitude that the Americans don't really care very much about the Iraqis. They like to talk about bringing them democracy, liberating them, but they care only about Western soldiers who killed. They don't really care about the lives of ordinary Iraqis. And over again, we've had examples of people shot by the Americans at the checkpoints, and the Americans have not even bothered to find out who they shot down, who they killed, who they wounded. They are not on the streets at night. We had one very sad case the other day of a man whose family I spoke to, who did survive. He was a night watchman at a building. His factory was attacked by looters. He fired back at the looters, and the Americans turned up and shot him in the chest. He's now just undergone, 2 days ago, his second operation to save his life. But he hasn't once been visited by American forces. No one said sorry. No one says, would you like some compensation? We can help you. In some cases, we do know, especially in outlying and very tough areas. The Americans and other Western forces have offered and given money of compensation to families of those they've killed. And I think the Americans were doing that to the policemen, at least eight of whom were killed by a U.S., I think the 3rd Infantry Division did it, near Fallujah on Thursday of last week. But outrageously, for a long time, the Americans just said they had no information about the killings, long after we'd gone there and established that it was all U.S. ammunition from an infantry unit that was used to kill the policemen. At one point, I found a policeman's teeth and brains beside the road. Had they been American brains and teeth, I don't think they would have been left there. It's this overall feeling, not so much, and I don't go along with conspiracy theories, that the U.S. want a civil war, want to divide people, want violence. No, because they're also becoming victims of it, though on an infinitesimally smaller scale than the Iraqis. But that the Americans don't really care about Iraqis. And that is the cancer that is eating into this society now.
Robert Fisk, I want to ask you about General Powell's visit, Secretary of State General Powell's visit to Baghdad. We still have Steve Rendell in the studio, who's leaving in 1 minute. As we listen to this description of what's happening in Iraq, we were wrapping up the discussion of Wesley Clark, whether or not he was for this war. Your final comments, Steve.
Well, I'd like to just say that politicians would like to be all things to all people. And our problem is not with Wesley Clark or his campaign. It's with the media's portrayal of him. Now, one point that I'd like to say, your listeners should really go and look at the daily column that Clark wrote for the Times of London right around the time of the fall of Baghdad. He wrote there, for instance, the day after the fall of Baghdad, he wrote, quote, liberation is at hand. Liberation, the powerful bomb that justifies painful sacrifices, erases lingering doubts and reinforces bold actions. He also wrote that George W. Bush and Prime Minister Blair, quote, should be proud of their resolve in the face of so much doubt. This is the day after, this is on April 10th, the day after the so-called fall of Baghdad. He was cheering this event, and it's very hard for us to see reporters casting him as an anti-war candidate.
Steve Rendell, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Robert Fisk, nothing succeeds like success. It sounds like people who didn't know how it was going to turn out wanted to make sure they were on the side of the winning forces, which makes me think of the piece you wrote where you said that Thomas Friedman was in Iraq. He asked a U.S. soldier, he was looking for something, for directions, and they said to him, that's on the enemy side of the bridge.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be reality-wise, Amy. Here in Baghdad, American troops are attacked up to, I'm told, 60 times a day, just in Baghdad alone. And they're losing an average amount a day. So if you're an American soldier, you're 20 years old, you didn't think it would work out like this, you were conned into believing the war was a great thing for democracy and liberation, and you're being shot at every day, you regard every Iraqi as a potential enemy. So of course the guy said, enemy side of the brick. It's a very telltale remark because it shows how terribly wrong everything has gone for the military, for the US administration, for our own dear Prime Minister Tony Blair. But individually, you find American soldiers here who you can be very sympathetic with, and who realize it's gone wrong. You know, I talk to US troops in the streets of Baghdad, and they do not want to vote for the Republican Party if they ever did before at the next election in the United States. You also find soldiers who are behaving very badly, with lack of fire discipline, lack of discipline in every kind. And I was down in Fallujah a few weeks ago when an American soldier saw a man sitting in a chair in the street and said, you get up and I'll break your fucking neck. Well, that is not the kind of language that's going to win hearts and minds. When I complained to his sergeant of the way he spoke, he made excuses and said, well, the guy got up at 3 o'clock this morning, he's been shot at every day, he's been here since March or whatever. So I said, well, you know, I understand all that. And one has to have sympathy as a human being for another human being who's in a predicament. But it was your country that wanted to invade this place. You were desperate to come in. You didn't want the arms inspectors to finish. You haven't found any weapons of mass destruction. Now you're here, and you don't like it. And this is a big problem over and over again. I'm finding soldiers who say, yes, you know, we believe we can help the Iraqi people. They take the line, mostly officers. But you find many, many officers below that who say, I want to go home. And this is an army that's tired, that's in low morale, low fire discipline, low discipline all around. The number of shootings of civilians is skyrocketing. You know, I've just been talking to you about the dead. If you go into a hospital here in the afternoon...
Robert, I want to ask you about... Robert, I'd like to ask you about this issue of low morale. Those of us who remember the Vietnam War understand that a major turning point was when those soldiers there realized that they were not engaged in a war of liberation, and gradually began to build up resistance and enormous morale problems with soldiers going AWOL and shooting their own officers at times. Are you seeing any signs that this demoralization among the troops may possibly even lead to resistance within the ranks of the soldiers?
Well, I say, whoa, there to you. We haven't reached the Vietnam stage yet. No one's fragging their own officers. There was an incident, wasn't there, in Kuwait, where I think a grenade was thrown by U.S. soldiers, another U.S. soldier. No, look, we haven't reached the Vietnam point, and after all, America was losing thousands of troops in Vietnam, and it's only in the hundreds in Iraq since the war began. And as I say, when I talk to ordinary soldiers, there's a great difference, for example, between units that were here during the war and haven't left, that actually fought in the war, lost quite a few people from then anyway, and are still here and feel that they've been lied to because they were supposed to have gone home after the victorious, wonderful war in which they were liberating people. And the newly arrived troops, like, for example, 101st Airborne up in Mosul, whose morale seems to be a lot higher, although, frankly, their attitude towards house raids and breaking down doors and screaming at people doesn't seem to be much better than, say, the 3rd Infantry Division, who clearly don't have the same moral problems. But we're not at the Vietnam stage, and we shouldn't pretend that we are. What we should compare it to is Lebanon in 1982, when it was 6 months before anyone threw a stone at an American soldier. And now, within 6 months, they've killed scores of American soldiers here in Iraq. And what has happened is that there is a real guerrilla army that will increasingly sophisticate. I was very interested to note when I met the U.S. general, who was in charge of prisoners of war at the former horrific Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad 3 days ago. She actually referred to a resistance force. You know, she didn't talk about terrorists, not once did it cross her lips. And what you find is that the real soldiers, I'm talking about non-reservists, full-time U.S. soldiers, they know they're involved in a guerrilla war. They know it's not working. They know the place is falling to bits. The problem, they tell me, is that when it gets up to the generals on your side of the lake, they don't want to admit. I had a colleague of mine on the State Department press corps, which arrived with Colin Powell, whom I was president of Powell's very strange press conference here. And my colleague told me that they still don't realize in Washington how bad it is. And that's the impression one gets on the ground here.
Why was it strange we only had 30 seconds? Your phone probably has less, but also I just wanted to get to Fallujah, to the U.S. soldiers who apparently came a day before, who killed something like eight Iraqi policemen and a Jordanian guard this month.
Yeah, well, I went down there. What obviously happened is the policemen, once they were on the fire, screamed, "We are the police, we are the police." The shooting went on. They then fled into the Jordanian army hospital compound, and the Americans then opened fire at the compound for up to 30 minutes, setting several of the buildings on fire. This is a hospital run by America's Jordanian allies. These are soldiers without fire discipline. You told me for the first time that I haven't even learned this here, that they just arrived in Iraq. Well, they clearly have a lot to learn, don't they?
The report is American soldiers just arrived in Fallujah the day before, but finally at the Powell press conference.
I'm sorry, Amy, the line broke there. Would you
just finally the Powell press conference.
Well, the extraordinary thing was that, you know, Powell presented everything as upbeat. He suggested that journalists were concentrating on negative things. He wasn't trying, he said, to persuade us how we should tell our stories, what our agenda should be, but we should concentrate on all the goodwill towards the occupation forces or the CPA, the coalition. Ambassador Bremer, the pro-consul here, American pro-consul, stepped forward to say there was more than 1,600,000 barrels of oil produced the previous day. It doesn't change the fact that Iraq is still importing oil, even though it's one of the richest oil countries in the world. But you simply couldn't get Powell in any question to talk about the fact that so many things were going wrong. And you wondered, had he brought the fantasy from Washington, or was he being fed the fantasy here in Baghdad by Bremer and his staff at the CPA? The fact is that months after the war was officially supposed to be over, there are hundreds of people dying in this country every week by violence. I'm just watching two Apache helicopters that are speaking to you now, flying just over the buildings in front of me, on anti-terrorist patrol, quote-unquote, as it's called. There is a real guerrilla war underway here, and when you're on the ground, you realize that it is moving out of control, and Washington is still trying to present this as a success story, and it's not any more than Afghanistan.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Robert Fisk, for being with us. Robert Fisk is a correspondent for the Independent newspaper based in Beirut right now in Iraq, returning as he has so many times. Thank you for joining us. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to talk about the attack John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, made on the country's largest library association, and then we're going to talk about the master terrorist that the administration has developed of 100,000 so-called terror suspects that was being sent out to businesses and government agencies. Stay with us.